Welcome to Transition Gadgets 360's gaming podcast, where we talk about all things games. Because surprise, surprise, in today's episode we have games editor Rishi Alwani
and friend of the podcast Mikhail Badnani. Sorry for the pause, I was buffering.
And here's our host Pranay Parab.
Yes.
unlike that bit of buffering here, we are going to be quickly resuming this podcast and talking about something that may or may not take a while because it's loading. Google Stadia, I guess. That is a new game streaming service from Google, which they are sort of cloaking as a hardware service also, because I guess you have to buy a controller to get
you
that.
You don't have to, but I wouldn't be surprised if people thought that way. But firstly, apologies to our regular listeners. We usually put up a podcast on Tuesday or Monday or Tuesday, but we thought this time around we'd wait a bit for Google to announce whatever it has in terms of Stadia. It's been an announcement that's been, you know, leaked a bit. It's been teased a bit, and now it's finally happened. So hopefully you'd appreciate this kind of detailed opinion and breakdown of all things Stadia and streaming and the state of games.
Yeah, so before we begin this, maybe first we want to talk about the fact that game streaming is not really something that's, you know, new or revolutionary as Google liked to claim yesterday in the keynote. Now, just to clarify, we're recording this on the 20th of March 2019, which is a day after Google's keynote happened, about 12 hours after Google's keynote took place. So in the keynote, we saw a bunch of things as usual. You know, all these tech companies like to show their new tech and scream that this is revolutionary, world exclusive, world premiere, and the most amazing thing to happen out there. But as always, there is fine print, and you know, not everything is as rosy as they'd like to paint it. So game streaming, I guess, has been around for like what, 10 years now?
I mean, I think longer than that if you consider what Nintendo used to do with the NES back in Japan in terms of internet connectivity and how you could play games on that service. And that was a short run that they did for a very short period of time, but it's pretty cool. So it's been around for a while. It's a concept that's existed. Now, what it basically means is much like Netflix, where you can, or Spotify, where you can essentially, where you don't need, you know, Blu-rays, you don't need audio CDs, you don't need vinyl, you don't need a vinyl player, you don't need a CD player, you don't need a Blu-ray player to watch your movies. Everything happens through the, as much as I hate the term, power of the cloud. And it's basically Google's attempt at this. We've had several attempts in the past, in the not so recent past.
OnLive.
Such as OnLive and Gakkai. Yeah. Gakkai, which got bought by Sony and is now basically PS Now, which is Sony's own streaming service. So it's been a thing and it's been around for a while. It's nothing particularly new. But what's interesting with Google's approach is, one, it's a company that has more money than God. Two, it's a company that has more money than God, but has also hired a ton of smart people. They've hired Phil. They've managed to get Phil Harrison, who is an executive at both Sony and Microsoft for PlayStation and Xbox, respectively. There's Jade Raymond, who is the associate, who is basically the producer for Assassin's Creed, and last was at EA Motive working on Star Wars.
She's now the head of their first party studio, which they've just announced yesterday.
Called Stadia Games and Entertainment, and they even hired people who've worked on PSVR. So. And Google in itself as a company, is known for its tech. They've got a pretty good idea on where that's going. Now, what they essentially announced was a streaming service where you could play any game on your smartphone, on your laptop, on your PC, or also on smart TVs or on Chromecast. And the whole idea is you don't need to use or buy a console. You don't need expensive PC hardware to play games. Now, in theory, it's basically been the goal for a lot of big game companies to do something like this, simply because it gets rid of any friction in terms of buying. Because let's be honest, particularly from an India standpoint, if you have to pay like a small fee, or you know, a subsidized with ads, where you don't have to buy or invest like, I don't know, 60-70k on a GPU, or you don't have to spend on a PlayStation 4, which is like around 30,000, you're just in with whatever tech you already have, with your expenses, with whatever internet you already have, then it's a game changer. But that's been the goal, and that's been something that not just Google, even Microsoft's working towards the same thing, and Sony has been as well. But at the end of the day, what they announced was data centers, which are using custom AMD GPUs, which are basically in line with the spec we've seen on Vega 56. They has 16 gigs of RAM, which are now what happens is the data centers with your high speed, which you can access through high speed internet, will let you play games on your devices. Now, there's no loading. That's what they claim. It's instant access. There's no loading. They claim there's that you can play games in 4K and HDR and eventually 8K as well. And there's also some, I mean, as with most things Google these days, there is integration with Google Voice Assistant, wherein you have a controller which you can buy. They haven't announced pricing on anything, mind you. So there's a controller you can buy which has Google Assistant built in, and it has a button that lets you share stuff directly to YouTube, and has an assistant button that lets you use it to get help in game. And there's also integration across Google's services. Now, one thing Sundar Pichai mentioned at the very beginning, and something that was harped on through their hour-long presentation, was the fact that that Stadia leverages the best of Google. Now, for them, the best of Google essentially means Gmail, YouTube, search. And what they meant by that essentially was developers will be able to link people to buy or try their games through Gmail, through YouTube, through search. And that's one way for them to enhance discoverability. While that sounds interesting, and that sounds like a way for, you know, everyone to, like, for example, if today I'm streaming a game on YouTube, Pranay can just click a play link there and join me at the same point in time in the game.
If so, developers like agree it. Checkpoints?
Pretty much, yeah. They invented checkpoints, apparently. So all that is there, and all that seems, you know, somewhat interesting. But there are some concerns as well, because for those of you, I mean, if you look at Google as a company and not just this one initiative as a silo, you'll notice that all these basically work on or lean on Google's existing infrastructure. At the end of the day, when you're allowing developers to push game links in every direction, it stands to benefit Google's advertising business. It stands to benefit their paid search results. When you're having a situation where everything is intensive on data centers, you're using Google's existing infrastructure that has a few tweaks. So in a way, it just seems to basically leverage existing tech with a few with some modifications here or there to make this feasible. I mean, it could be one of the possibilities of the future that, yeah, you know, the world shifts to a cloud-first gaming infrastructure. But I feel there are issues with that.
So I've seen a lot of, like, obviously whenever any big company announces plans for streaming or even hints at streaming, always they're like websites to start posting streaming is the future, everything that and all. But one thing to note is while sure music sales have honestly cratered and basically everyone just downloads music or mostly streams music now, people have forgotten that with Blu-rays at least and movies, Blu-rays are still quite a big thing because, like, look at the download sizes for high quality movies and just... that's like going to be the deciding factor over here. Streaming, sure, like I think it's going to be something which eventually a lot of companies will have their own version of, and it'll probably work out well when people have the internet for it. That's another thing. Google didn't actually discuss the internet bandwidth requirements for this, but we'll get to that in a bit. So I think, like, gaming, like, regardless of what happens in the future with streaming, there's always going to be people who need to buy this stuff physically. Like, look at movies, 4K, Blu-rays. Can you imagine downloading that stuff, like, you know, for watching it online? How many people even do that now versus buying it over here with the internet connections which people have in India?
Yeah, and while the internet connection situation has kind of fixed its rectified itself to a degree, what with Jio and every other ISP and telco dropping rates, but what is also there is that it's fixed it to a certain degree on a certain spec. So we're looking at a situation where 1080p, 720p streams are fine. It's something people would don't mind bothering with. 480p is already chill when it comes to YouTube. The point is it's seeing people being aware of their options. We're seeing it with games as well, right? I mean, PUBG Mobile, from what we know, has an estimated 30 million audience in India. And that game is a 1.7 gigabyte download without counting the extra maps. So my point is, it's getting there. The internet situation is evolving, but we're not at a point where, for example, I mean, if I'm not mistaken, right, with a 4K stream from Netflix, you're going through 5 gigabytes of data. And if you're looking at PS Now, a 720p stream for your game is around 2.5 gigabytes per hour.
Like, the thing is, yeah, with streaming videos, obviously Netflix, Amazon Prime and all have their own way of delivering it. And videos are, like, fixed, yeah, entities. It's not something which actually changes depending on your input, where, like, essentially you need to have more data ready for you to do something. Like, think of even a situation like Assassin's Creed. You know, when you switch to the Eagle in, like, say, yeah, Origins and Odyssey. the other data has to be ready for you to load, so that loads in more data. It's not like a movie where, you know, this thing is just going to buffer the same fixed amount of, say, like, remember when movies used to be on a single DVD or a single CD at 700 MB? That was a fixed 700 MB regardless of when you fast-forwarded or rewound or whatever. Over here, like, suppose you're streaming a game at 480p, that's going to be a lot larger than 700 MB because you keep switching between, like, it's honestly going to be a similar situation to, like, PS1 games where you have to switch discs and stuff in terms of how much you have to keep loading back into your bandwidth pipe over here. So it's always going to be a lot more. So if whether people can stream 1080p videos now without issues, or 1080p 60fps footage on YouTube without issues, being able to stream that for a game is a whole other ballpark where you have to look at latency, you have to look at your inputs being uploaded, stuff like that. So I don't know, like, a lot of I've seen a lot of people saying that, oh, I can already stream Netflix in HD, so I'll be able to stream Google Stadia very easily. That's not the case. It's completely different. Google will also, like, they haven't even announced plans for India yet. It's just coming to the UK, Europe, USA, and Canada this year.
Yeah, pretty
while
much.
Microsoft is actually looking to, like, roll out their public tests, like, on a larger scale. And Microsoft and Google are probably the only two companies that actually have a ton of data centers in India versus the others, right? Am I right?
Yeah, that's pretty true. Even though, that being said, I mean, Valve does have a data center here. In fact, multiple across most metros in India. And we've seen even, I mean, other companies like Sony, has, for example, has been taking an interest in bringing PS Now for the longest time. But they don't have any infrastructure here, even though they had a testing facility. But point is, at the end of the day, it becomes a situation where, you know, you need to have the infrastructure built in. This ends up, at least from a developer standpoint, being a situation where, from Google's standpoint, being a situation where if you don't have the data centers, there's no point. And a lot of the presentation was focused on the data centers, your console, you don't have to worry about buying hardware. That's great. I mean, it makes sense for them. But then the problem here is, one is latency. And while they did talk up stuff like Doom, right? Doom Eternal running at 4K, 60fps with HDR via Stadia, which makes sense when you consider, you know, it's a Twitch shooter. It's a game that requires low latency. That's great to show off. That's great to sell people on the idea. But at the same time, they did mention Battle Royale. They said that Battle Royale multiplayer is an option as well. But, I mean, saying it and then is one thing. But then they should have showed off something there, right? Because today, if GeForce Now can play games like Rainbow Six Siege, can play games like PUBG, and do it with relatively okay latency, well, what's stopped Google from looking at that as well? I mean, if you really want to sell the audience on the service, you'd want to bring that in. And to be honest, while Google is trying to democratize gaming in its own way like this, with its own vision of gaming, this is something at this point in time that seems to be geared towards the hardcore crowd, because you're talking up stuff like 4K HDR, you're talking up stuff like 8K gaming.
60fps, don't forget that.
And 60fps too, right? These are some things that mostly core gamers talk about. And honestly, when you're targeting that audience, they already have local hardware that doesn't bother about latency. And to me, it just seems like a positioning mismatch of the highest degree, because a service like this is meant to bring more people into the system. And more people who come into the system, they quite really don't care about how many pixels are on screen or what the how much HDR is there in a game. And in fact, that's the case with most gamers. So I felt that instead of talking up the tech, the tech and features, they should have just focused on, you know, accessibility, availability, why you should care, and probably focus on a larger rollout.
I think, like, they should have taken sort of the Apple approach, where Apple never, like, waste time on spec.
Yes.
In their presentations, like, they do it, you know, like, they'll just say, oh, the processor's like twice as fast, that's it. They're not gonna, I don't think they actually waste time, like, you know, when you have a console presentation for a new hardware, you talk about teraflops and all that. That stuff is like maybe 1/10 or 1/50 of what Apple talks about in their presentation. They, like, when they talk about the camera, they'll show you pictures, they'll show you stuff, and they'll say, you know, this is great for photographers and stuff like that. They aren't going to say, oh, by the way, if you take a picture with this and you zoom in over here, this is the whatever, like, you know, I don't even know camera terms, but yeah. They don't waste time on unnecessary things, which the people who are attending the conference would do. Like, sure, they invited gaming press and all, but then this is not, like, catering just to them. This is for the mass public, I'd say, not just for, like, you know, people who are already hardcore gamers. Like, saying the it like when you said mismatch, it kind of makes sense because half the presentation seemed geared toward a more casual audience who would be into gaming through this, and the other half would be for the people who are, like, you know, already anti-mobile and anti any technology that's not, you know, hardcore PC and console games. So I think they should have spent a different, they should have either had a different presentation on that or catered towards one group first and then looked at the other instead of like doing this thing with like a mishmash between both.
Yeah, and there's, and the other thing is while you can say that parts of it made sense because it's a GDC, but at the end of the day, this is Google. They could have had the event anywhere, any place where it would have actually made more sense. To me, it just seemed like they're treating this more like an E3 kind of thing. Where, you know, you talk up hardcore stuff like, you know, spec, you talk up stuff like 4K HDR. But at the end of the day, when this is something you want to democratize, or at least try to democratize, and when you want to call this as your vision of gaming, it could have just worked as a standalone event. And to me, what's perhaps the most disturbing is we have no price at all. We have no idea if this is going to be subsidized by ads.
Yeah, it will be most likely, knowing Google. You really think that, okay, fine, maybe, okay, the markets they are launching in, they could do a subscription service, but then seeing as what they did with the YouTube Originals program, I think it YouTube Red, it was called, right?
Yes.
They made it, first of all, like it was paid, and then after that, they realized that, okay, it's not working, so let's bring it to everybody and like let's get rid of the subscription entirely and make it, you know, available for free with ads. So I'm guessing they would do a free with ads a tier, and maybe start with like a paid subscription if you want games, whatever. They'll probably price match with Xbox Game Pass or some service like that.
I don't
that.
Know if it's going to be matched with Xbox Game Pass, because like it's still too soon for them to launch. Like what they're launching now, I still don't even think it's going to be the full version. They'll probably still do like a beta first where they launch on certain devices. It's obviously going to be Android first, even though they should launch on iOS if they want like a paying audience and stuff.
Yeah, but the other thing is, if they do and iOS, they might run the same issues Steam ran.
Yeah, the thing about the way Steam handles it is, like, I don't know, Apple's rules with this stuff is always inconsistent. Like PS4 Remote Play got approved, but Steam's thing wasn't approved, while we don't know if Steam actually ended up resubmitting, although they have a build which is without purchasing or with purchasing disabled, which is what Apple's rules said. So Google could have a situation where they like let you not, you know, you can't buy stuff directly. You have to pay for it separately. I mean, that's the same thing as Google Play Music, right, on iOS.
Yeah, pretty
and a
much.
Lot of services have basically been removing in-app purchases to subscribe, where you have to sign up on their own website.
Yeah.
Google could do the same thing. And the thing is, Doom Eternal, Assassin's Creed Odyssey, these aren't games that are going to come to iOS natively anyway. So Apple's not really losing out in that sense.
Yeah, and I mean, there are other concerns too, right? Like, for example, companies like Ubisoft, while they're usually great at launching games, they make a lot of their revenue on recurring purchases, be it in-app purchases, be it microtransactions, be it all sorts of things. Now, my point is, when you're offering a service like Stadia, I mean, the possible business models, and considering how Google has been positioning it to be like the Netflix for gaming, this would possibly fall into a subscription category. Now, how does someone like Ubisoft, who spent a ton of money on a game like Assassin's Creed Odyssey, make back their revenue? How do you justify putting stuff on Stadia? And to me, the only answer that comes to this is that there's some next level money hatting going on. And I would love to see what the actual P&L is on Stadia. But my point is, yeah, it's going to be interesting to see how publishers and developers make money on this. Some of the indies, and I think we touched upon this on our last podcast, some of the indies are really worried about streaming hardware eating into revenues. Because in these situations, usually the business model is that you're paid per minutes played. And the other questions are, how do you manage discoverability? Is there a Stadia store? Is it just going to be links across the internet? How is Google managing that? We still don't know that either. So there are a ton of concerns across the board. And I mean, hopefully Google iron this out before a launch.
Yeah, so maybe this will appeal to all those people who like are hooked to AAA online games.
Yeah.
I don't know. People who play, Division, I guess.
I don't know. I mean, honestly, the Division 2 online, when you're playing it also, it works in the state it's in right now. Is because at the end of the day, you already have that. I mean, you don't have to worry too much about netcode. It works pretty fine on existing netcode, provided you've made the initial... I mean, obviously, once you've downloaded the game, the netcode's pretty good. Even on a 3G connection, when you've played the game.
Yeah, right, because now, that's really because good. It doesn't use P2P from what I know.
Yep.
P2P is where the real issue comes in, like the point you're bringing up where, like, you know, this will have trouble for games like that. Like, I don't see... Like, I'm sure Google wants to push this for fighting games, but I cannot see this working for people playing fighting games online. I just, like, I don't know, because fighting games have too many variables for, like, frame delays and stuff like that, and you already have a lot of popular games like Tekken 7 and even Super Smash Bros. Ultimate, which really have online issues because of how the netcode's implemented. But then you have other games like Killer Instinct, which is absolutely flawless online.
That's because no one's playing it.
But then that goes against what the netcode is, right? Because there are no dedicated servers for fighting games. Exactly. It's always P2P, so it's how they implement that. The dedicated server thing would come into the picture with, like, the Division 1, which had a lot of server issues, and even how MMOs have, like, queues. That's when you have dedicated servers. Fighting games will never run into server issues as such because you're connecting directly to the other person. How they implement the connection is the real thing. So, I don't know. I just don't see it working out for Google for fighting games, at least right now. But then, everything, there are too many variables right now. Like, before the price, which is obviously like a big factor, I still need to know the bandwidth requirements for this because price is secondary, honestly. There's no point in, like, you know, even if it's 5 rupees a day or something, if it's some nonsense like that, if it needs something like 200 Mbps or something, it's just not going to be feasible for me.
Yeah, and actually, that 200 Mbps figure you've quoted is actually what most people are testing it on.
Okay.
So, Video Game Tech Analysis site Digital Foundry had first impressions of Google Stadia at GDC, and they basically mentioned that they were using it with a LAN connection connected to a router with 200 Mbps of bandwidth, and over there they still saw a button to pixel latency of around 179 milliseconds, which is not that great. And at the same time, when they checked it on Wi-Fi through the same connection, it was the most consistent was 166 milliseconds. And Google apparently offers developers a worst case scenario mode, allowing them to test for adverse conditions, which simulates a poor noisy 15 Mbps DSL connection.
Wow.
Yeah.
Poor noisy 15 Mbps DSL connection.
Yeah, that's how Digital Foundry has described it. Their words, not mine.
Just great. I mean, if this is true, then it's really like it basically assumes that you need first world internet for this thing to work.
So here's the thing. Yeah. According to the quick latency test they did, what they saw was 166 milliseconds, which also included display lag in certain situations, with a 200 Mbps line. With a 15 Mbps connection, which was a simulation mode, by the way, designed to mimic the response on unstable connections, with the image quality also taking a hit, which used to be 1080p, now is 720p, and also difference in quality. So that was at 188 milliseconds. And then Project Stream, which is what Stadia was known in its beta test, for the lack of a better term, that had 179 milliseconds latency, with latency inclusive of display lag. So depending on the monitor you're using, you could see that went up to 200 milliseconds. As Mike said, there are other variables you have to take into consideration. And if you compare this to latency on PC, which is very fascinating, latency on PC without including for display lag is 112 milliseconds. With display lag, it's 133 milliseconds at 30 FPS. These are 30 FPS numbers. As you can see, there are more factors coming in at each step, right? You have the display lag, which is depending on the screen you're using. You have the frame rate, which becomes another factor, because PC at 60 FPS has a latency of 79 milliseconds. PC at 60 FPS with display lag is 100 milliseconds. And Xbox One X, and this is the interesting one, Xbox One X is 145 milliseconds latency. But if you include display lag, it's 166. Now, again, keep in mind that these numbers are essentially tested on Google's own environment. So there is a good chance that we could see it becoming better or worse when it actually rolls out. But this is an indicator of what you can expect. TLDR, if you have a PC that's decent enough, you may not have to bother with this. And a lot of this also, again, is as Mike said, has a lot of variables. You have your internet, you have what frame rate you want to play at, you have situations where your monitor or TV could result in lag as well. So there are a lot of things that impact the experience. And I have a feeling that we're going to see, I mean, like, for example, right, when you're using this on something like a phone with a 1080p display, it might look better, it might look playable, but then you're going to run into issues with older titles, at least, where you have text, a lot of text on a smaller screen. That doesn't scale too well. Something like, you know, menus in a game like Destiny.
So the other thing is, like, you know, having tried PlayStation's remote play over, like, cellular through tethering and stuff like that, I've noticed a lot of this obviously works really well for turn-based games. Like Dragon Quest XI, Persona 5, absolutely fantastic, works fine. You can, like, you know, slowly use the menus to, like, put in input commands for the combat and stuff like that. And I think that's why they actually use Doom Eternal, because that's a game where you need, like, super quick inputs and stuff like that.
Yep.
But I don't know, like, there are just too many variables right now for... I hope they do a public trial where they let people, you know, try out... they partner with some developer for trying out some game as such, because as of now, unless people try it out, no one is going to be sold on it. It's just like a lot of here's a proof of concept which we can show you in a closed environment, but people need to see it work in the real world, which is what I think Microsoft might end up doing faster than Google with the Project xCloud.
Though with xCloud, we did see they did have one demo which kind of looked.
The thing is, that was still a demo, right? You need people to try this for them to buy into it.
True.
You can't just like say, oh, by the way, here's something that works and all, trust us, we promise, or something. You need people to try it, like give them a month to try it and stuff like that. Heck, people weren't sold on Game Pass as well until they tried it for a month or two, and then suddenly it's like, oh my God, this is the Netflix of gaming or whatever. So yeah, like there are too many things which are like question marks right now, especially for India with no launch even like mentioned.
Yeah.
At least not with the it's pretty sad that I don't know, like Google usually would put India at the forefront when they announce anything, right? Like
But at the end of the day, you also got to look at the fact that I think for India, what the approach they'll take is bundle it straight to the ISPs. I won't be surprised.
That's very possible.
I mean, considering Google's done stuff with Assistant to customize it for iOS for geophones, there's nothing stopping Google from partnering with Jio to actually bring this to light here, or partnering with any other ISP like Act or Hathaway for that matter. So we won't be surprised to see that. Plus, also a lot of it is dependent on 5G rollout, and India doesn't have anything planned just yet.
I mean, when 4G actually became a thing, the speeds dropped for everyone almost, I think.
Yeah, so that's a point I wanted to raise, actually. Like, if anybody has used 4G in India, they'll realize that it's probably closer to, like, 2.5 or 2G abroad in many, like, Western countries, maybe such as the US. Every time I've been to the US or UK, I'm just surprised that, you know, like, I buy one of those cheap travel SIM cards.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's, like, I always am surprised that, okay, 3G works so fast. This is faster than 4G that I'm used to back home. And now I'm not talking about speed test results, which I'm pretty sure are gamed in some way or the other, but actual like loading sites and all, the same sites load much faster. My, like, you know, the site we work for, Gadgets360, that loads faster on 3G abroad than it does on 4G in India. So if you're waiting for 5G rollouts and you're hoping that, you know, you'll get a certain speed on 5G, like worst case scenario abroad, I think most people will be in for a rude shock when they try to use these things in India, because 5G, even if it rolls out in India, the speeds are not going to be the same. Like, I don't understand this tech very well, but from what I know, that's partly due to congestion. Like, the density of population is much higher over here. The number of people who use smartphone networks is much higher here than it is abroad. So even if you have like the latest internet technologies out here, that is always going to be an issue, and speeds are not going to be what they are abroad. And this is going to be a problem for all game streaming services. Now, the points you brought up are all legit. Like, you know, what happens to indie games? What happens to retro games? You can barely read text on, you know, like the screens that you'll be using them as. For example, somebody plays this on an Android phone. I doubt if the game is going to be very well optimized to render all text properly over there. And who is making money from this?
Like, exactly.
Who is? Like, I really can't understand, you know, how people are going to make money from this. If AAA games are going to come to this, fine. They obviously, like, they already have online subscriptions, etc. in place. Stuff like GTA Online, if you look at it, it still mints money, right? That's why they don't have to bother.
I think it's going to just be like, you know, when you're watching a movie on Netflix, how do they make money through that? Netflix has its own, you know, you subscribe to Netflix, so they earn from that. And depending on how you stream now, what terms they have with developers remains to be seen.
Yeah, but at the same time, also it's also important to note that for Netflix, this the streaming part of it is their core business. Google has been we've seen Google in the past not being able to turn around certain services that may have launched with some fanfare, like Google Plus, for example.
Did Google Plus ever have fanfare, though?
Yeah, when it launched.
What about Google Reader?
That's my point, right? And Google Hangouts, for example, right? Yeah. They aren't able to turn it around or make it relevant. And we've even seen this right now with their hardware lineup. We've seen this with the Pixel Books and their the
Nexus. Remember
the Nexus? Yeah, that's
haven't
my
heard
point.
That. Haven't heard that name in a long time.
So I mean, with their laptop and tablet division, they've basically told engineers find other jobs within the companies. So my point is, it'll be interesting to see how much patience and appetite they have for risk for something as intensive as this. I mean, sure, the allure is there, the payoff is there, and I'm sure there is. They've probably worked it out in such a way where, you know, certain other divisions of Google benefit. But, I mean, it'll be interesting to see from a corporate level.
Tom Clancy's Google division.
There we go. Yeah. How they work that out.
Yeah, exactly. Like, even I'm, you know, looking forward to see that. And also, like, I don't know, like, I can't frame this thought properly. Like, I haven't thought this through, maybe. But, like, it's not exactly like Netflix, right? Because for Netflix, what happens is once you produce a movie, it's out there, and all you have to do is then sell the broadcasting rights to like X, Y, and Z region people. So, you know, it comes to Netflix because Netflix has bid for the rights in Bombay or in India, for example, and you get that movie here. So the production crew doesn't have to do any more work other than, you know, send them the prints or whatever. Whereas for games, now, I guess you have that whole thing of like updates coming after release and all of that, and a bunch of other support things are also needed to be supported, right? So it's not just like, okay, we made the game, it's over and it's done with, and there's no further investment in that game.
No, there is a recurring cost. And yeah. I mean, while the updates don't come to users, they'll have to be sent to data centers at least.
Yeah, so...
And those also require testing. Now, tomorrow, what if you have a situation where a bad update's just been put on the game?
Yeah, and like, how does the monetization work now in that case? Like, in a subscription service, for example, for like, if music streaming, whatever, for that, or movies, you have a subscription service and like, people are being paid a cut of the revenue every time someone plays. So... Fine, I mean, in that case, you know, if people listen to your music, you make money. But once you made the music, it's not like you constantly have to support it and update it
exactly.
Or whatever, right? It's out there and you're making royalties, just like how you would do for books. For games, it's a bit different, and I'm not entirely sure if the recurring cost that's there will be covered by this revenue that the streaming service will generate. And especially when, you know, AAA games are going to dominate here. Like, stuff like GTA Online is, you know, prime target audience for this. Whatever, like, maybe even PUBG, for example. That's also probably going to be, you know, something that people are going to be looking for. But the smaller ones, I'm not sure whether, you know, like, single-player offline games are going to be suited for this one. And especially the ones that we prefer, which is narrative-driven games. Yeah.
But, like, Persona 5 and stuff like that would work really well through this, right? Imagine you're playing it at home. Now, you know, everyone's going to, like, jump and say that, you know, that's the Switch. You can play it at home and you can take it anywhere. But the thing is, Switch battery life is terrible. It's not really portable. Like, it's not something you can pocket. So having something like this, which you can literally play on any display, that's a good concept.
Plot twist. We still don't know how much of an impact this can have on battery life either.
We don't know anything, honestly. Like, all they've done is shown us a vision, which is frankly something that Microsoft has shown us last year.
Yeah,
During E3.
Yeah, pretty much.
So, I mean, I'm okay, fine. Like, it's a good thing that game streaming is coming here. It's a good thing that they want to democratize it. But what worries me is that it's Google, whose entire business is based on advertising and collecting your data.
Pretty much.
So that, you know, it doesn't really bode well. And it's also Google, which is known to like launch products with great fanfare and then sort of, you know, quietly shut them down later. So that is another worrying thing. Then, you know, it's not even like a company such as Microsoft, which will maybe, you know, even if they're making losses, you know, at least they are going to put some investment in it and try to make it work.
I mean, there's also Games for Windows Live that was a thing at one point. So yeah. It's not like, you know, they're like completely like they have this halo on their head. There's another halo in there.
No, we don't go there yet. Anyway, so yeah, point is, it's I mean, I think the question is, at the end of the day, it just boils down to this. As a consumer, is this something sustainable? God knows at this stage. But I mean, you can rest assured that Google will want everyone to try it out. So we'll probably know more around launch. But
yeah, all I want to know is like how much minimum internet speed they can work with whenever they launch. Because that's the most concerning aspect for me. Because in India, you don't get enough speeds. Even on high-speed connections, you rarely ever get good bandwidth.
Exactly. And the other problem here is, at least from a pure game preservation standpoint, is what if we have a situation where every game is streaming only? What happens to preservation of games? What happens of games as an art form? Is that something, or what's Google's take on all of that? At least Microsoft has initiatives in place. Sony has or is looking at initiatives. And heck, Valve is pretty much at the forefront of that too, as is GOG. Because at the end of the day, you have stuff on Steam. The Valve has safeguards in place to ensure that in the event they want to close Steam, you can still play your games. Gabe Newell has talked about this.
Have we actually seen anything for this, or is this like just another thing which, like, you know, Valve announces a lot of things, like what happened to Steam Link on iOS?
True. But then
I agree that a game being on Steam has a much larger chance of being preserved in general versus being on console. That's objectively true.
Yeah.
But still, like, GOG is like 100% secure for preservation because there's no DRM. There are games on Steam with no DRM, but exactly. GOG's whole game plan is to get games which you don't even need GOG Galaxy to install almost all the games.
Exactly. So that's the whole thing, right? Like, at the end of the day, that's a bigger concern because it's something we talk about on occasion. There are games people want to come back to. There are games people want to keep playing. And we also don't know if it's going to be a situation like Game Pass. With Game Pass, games keep leaving the service.
Yeah, just like Netflix. I mean, exactly. They keep posting that here are the games arriving in Game Pass this month. And yeah, there are always a few games which leave because games don't just remain there permanently. Some games are there for a long time. But yeah, you can't just assume everything's going to be there. So that's why if there's a game which arrives on Game Pass and you subscribe, you may as well finish it when you can. So you can move on when it gets pulled.
Or you can just, you know, buy a game on disc.
Yeah, how did that work out with the Division 2 on PS4, Rishi?
I don't know. I played it on PC. So.
Anyway, so I think we can move on to the games we've been playing this week. Now, I will start first. Once again, I've been playing Persona 5. Welcome to 2017 to me, etc.
Go to sleep.
You should be streaming it now.
You should be sleeping.
Come on, man. Let me take my time and like talk about this game.
Go to sleep.
So, that's the most annoying part of Persona 5. Like, 49 hours into the game, and I'm still seeing tutorials. I can't figure out for the life of me, like, how many more tutorials there are going to be there in this game.
It's okay. But Devil May Cry 5 has a tutorial at the final boss.
But it's not 120 hours long.
It can be if you play it at second, third, fourth, fifth, you know.
Yeah, yeah. So, if I do that to Persona 5, then that game is, like, I don't know, 10,000 hours long.
No, I mean, Persona 5, I know a lot of people have played it twice because you need to play it twice for the Platinum Trophy.
Yeah.
So, yeah, there is... But, like, I think everyone, including myself, I thought when I was playing Persona 4 Golden, I was like, best game ever, need to finish this, need to get the Platinum Trophy. After I finished it, I was, like, too long. Hmm. Same thing for Persona 5.
Yeah, so anyway, so I am now, I finished this third castle, palace, actually. Which is that Kanishiro's palace. Now I have to sort of send the calling card. I think that's where I have saved my game.
By iMessage.
Or maybe Google Hangouts. Never know. Anyway, so now what I found annoying here was that in the third dungeon, right, you get this new confidant called Makoto, who's like a playable character, has really cool powers, which is nuclear damage. And most characters, most enemies in that dungeon are weak to nuclear or not strong to nuclear. Basically, nobody can resist nuclear. Very, very few of them. So what happens is throughout the dungeon, I use this character's powers, blast it through everybody. But since, you know, you can't like level up the confidant rank to get that basic ability of baton pass, it's if the character like basically makes somebody weak. So you have like maybe five personas attacking you. So Makoto's powers will make three of them weak. And then you can sort of do a baton pass and then give it to another character and basically attack the other two characters with their weaknesses. So it's sort of difficult to explain, but anyway, just assume that, you know, Makoto doesn't have all the powers necessary to like weaken all other personas. So you can quickly finish it off in two moves. You have to like still do that in three or four moves because that baton pass is not there in this one. But now that I've cleared the dungeon, I'm going to spend some time ranking up the confidant and figuring out, you know, how to take life from there. So enjoyed that bit. Now just got to finish this Kaneshiro boss fight. And after that, I'm done with this third dungeon and can move on to, you know, doing regular things like meeting that fortune teller lady, which is, you know, still pending on my list. I did so much grinding in this dungeon, so much grinding because I was reading one guide and somebody had mentioned that you need a lot of money after this because that fortune teller lady is very, like, first time you meet her, you have to spend some 100,000 yen.
Oh, yeah, that crystal stone
So, you have to spend 100,000 yen for that. So, I basically, the first part of this third dungeon, I played that through some 15 times to make some 70,000-80,000 yen. And I finished this dungeon, like, did all my persona fusion and everything, got that, the twin warden's rank up to 4. And like now I'm left with some 175,000 yen. Hopefully this should be enough for the coming days. But yeah, that's my biggest complaint so far. Like I'm struggling for money. But I guess as a high school student, I really can't expect much more than that. But still, I should have played this game in 2017. I am playing it in 2019. Don't regret the fact that I'm playing it now. But yeah, I should have played it in 2017. That's, yeah, one big miss. When the next Persona game comes out, I'll probably be playing it day one. But yeah.
In so which decade?
God knows. I don't know. Anyway, hopefully after this, maybe I'll start Yakuza Kiwami whenever I finish this one, which is probably going to take another month or so. Or I don't know. Let's see. If certain other factors work out, maybe it'll be a Dragon Quest game. Who knows? Anyway, Mike, what have you been playing?
So there's this new indie game which just showed up on PC and Switch called Baba Is You. I had literally completely forgotten about this game until it just randomly released and everyone kept comparing it to The Witness and I loved that game. So I was like, let me give this a shot. Like, let me check what it's about. So it's basically this game where you use programming logic to move the rules around. So like when you start the game, you'll be in a random level, which is like pretty basic. And then you'll have these blocks, which is like Baba Is You, which is you're essentially this white dog or rabbit or something. And then there'll be another thing which says flag is win, rock is push. So that means you can push the rock and you have to get to the flag to win. Now, as the levels progress, you can move these rules around and you have to move them and more stuff happens. So like in one of them, you can literally move win and is to Baba and then you just win the level. But there are some cases where they'll block certain things to the corners where you can't actually access them. Then they add teleporters and stuff like that. And it follows a similar thing as The Witness, where you start out in one area of this big island and you can move around as you unlock more stuff and all. So it's like just blowing my mind just how well designed this game is and stuff. It's only on Switch and PC and not just Steam. It's on itch.io, Humble and a lot of stores and all.
Is it on Epic Game Store?
Not yet.
Disappointing.
Is so it yeah, on PS4?
It'll probably show up just like, you know, when in 2013 when Sony and Steam were basically the go-to platforms for indies. Now it's like Switch and PC. So it'll probably show up eventually. But like right now it's just on Switch. Just absolutely loving it. It's perfect.
Waiting for physical copy.
It probably will happen. And the good thing about this game is like, you know, just like The Witness, you keep booting it up, just trying to finish a level and don't. It boots up super quick on Switch. So that's really
But
nice.
Does it happen in 5 seconds with instant access like Stadia?
I think it's not 5 seconds, a little more than that. But yeah, it's very fast. Music is really good. And just like absolutely loving it. Hopefully, I'll be done with it in like a week or two or something. But like some of the levels are like really, really obtuse. If you played something like Human Resource Machine, which also uses some of these programming logic based puzzles, then yeah, you'll really like this. I think anyone should just look at it. And other than that, been playing some ports of old games. There's this game called The Caligula Effect, which Rishi reviewed and even I reviewed on Vita a long time ago. It was really bad on the Vita. So yeah, it got ported to PS4, Switch and PC. Been playing it on Switch and yeah, like some of the gameplay additions and story additions are really nice and all, but not happy with the visuals at all. Like was hoping, you know, on a more powerful platform, a Vita game would run well, but instead of getting a Vita game ported, they designed it for PS4 in Japan first. They did it in Unreal Engine 4 and also it's a PS4 game ported to Switch and usually as in this case they don't end up really being too great and yeah, honestly not really happy with the visuals and performance and I just got reminded of how good the music was and yeah, just not really enjoying the game much as such. Still playing Dead or Alive 6 on Xbox and unlocked more stuff, replaying the arcade mode because they have this thing where you can unlock they have this timed event where you can unlock more stuff quicker right now. And the last game I'm playing is still Trials Rising. Absolutely love it. So you're going to keep playing that for a long time now.
Yeah, the only Trials game I've played is something on iOS, which released a few...
First Trials game I've played. A lot of people are saying it's similar to the others. I have no idea. I'm enjoying this. How about you, Rishi? How have you been dividing your time?
So I've been playing The Division 2. The core gameplay mechanics are good enough to keep me coming back. It's a lot of fun, even post-review. I'm still enjoying it, particularly the co-op with friends. It's a lot of fun to play. What pisses me off with the game, though, is... all right, here's the thing. You basically have a game where your home base is the White House. It's a game where where the character's backpack has the American flag on it. It's a game where Ubisoft sent out mailers talking about how you can experience the government shutdown. But at the same time, the game doesn't do anything with its politics or political setting to say anything at all. It's just window dressing, which I feel is a missed opportunity, particularly when you consider how games have actually excelled in this department. We've had games like BioShock, all three of them for that matter, which actually talk up political themes and do it in a way that's intelligent, that's meaningful, that sparks conversation. We've had it with Spec Ops: The Line, for that matter, which actually talks about the horrors and atrocities of, you know, war and how it should be dealt with. But over here, it's pretty much just reduced to window dressing and one Nicolas Cage meme where you basically have to steal back the Declaration of Independence. Cool story, bro. But yeah, I mean, the core mechanics, the gameplay is fantastic. The story is a missed opportunity. And it's still interesting, but yeah, mainly for the game, from a gameplay aspect. That aside, I have been also checking out Borderlands 2 again. Simply because...
On what?
On PC.
Okay.
Simply because we're due for an announcement of Borderlands 3, it seems.
And maybe, maybe by the time this podcast goes up, there'll be some Borderlands news. We don't know. It's supposed to happen this week, basically.
Yeah, so... that'll be interesting to see. Rumor has it that the game is going to be on Epic Games Store too, which should be interesting considering that platform has attracted a fair share of haters. Though, personally, in my experience, I pretty much like the Epic Games Store. It does some new stuff. So, that's there too. So, I mean, basically been playing The Division 2, Borderlands 2. But yeah, that's about it.
All right, then. That's all we have for this episode of Transition. Yeah. We'll be back with one more episode next week, hopefully on Monday. Mm-hmm. Once again, apologizing for a couple of days delay for this week. Mm-hmm. And once more, I would like to thank Magnus Solai Paulsen, whose album PPP PPP is where all the tracks for this podcast come from.
Oh, wait. Before you end this, speaking of VVVVVV, it's actually going to get a physical release, which has been leaked by eBay sellers.
Hmm.
And the physical release is apparently going to be on Vita and Switch.
Okay.
So yeah, we'll buying have more it. News hopefully
For
soon.
Sure buying it. One of my favorite games of all time. Everyone should play VVVVVV. Captain Viridian. What a legendary character. Anyway, so you can follow us on Facebook, Twitter, YouTube and Instagram at Gadgets360. If you have any questions, comments or feedback, write to us at podcast@gadgets360.com. We'll be back with one more episode next week.